From WYPR, we're on the record. I'm Sheila Cass. Good morning. Looking back a century, Americans tend to see prohibition in soft focus, as a noble but misguided experiment that, by making liquor illegal, romanticized it. Today, speakeasies are a nifty party theme, and rum running seems glamorous. But prohibition, enforced from 1920 until it was repealed in 1933, was serious, often deadly, business, both for those who wrenched huge profits from smuggling illicit booze into the U.S., and for the federal agents who tried to block them. In her latest novel, Annapolis writer Erica Roebuck pulls us inside the thoughts and motivations of two clever, determined women, one on either side of that legal chasm. These were real-life women. Special Agent Elizabeth Smith Friedman, cryptanalyst with the U.S. Coast Guard Intelligence Department, and her adversary, Marie Waite, a smuggler who aspires to be the queen of the rum runners around South Florida, with or without her lout of a husband. When it comes to using the techniques of fiction to expand what the historical record has captured about formidable women, Erica Roebuck is a master. We spoke with her 2 years ago about two female spies, an American and a Brit, in World War II, and 3 years ago about the Baltimore-born socialite Virginia Hall, whose skill as a spy enraged the Nazis. Her new book is called The Last 12 Miles. Erica Roebuck is with me in the studio. Welcome back to the show.
I'm so happy to be back here. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Why that title, The Last 12 Miles?
That's a great question to kick this off. Before Prohibition, we had 3 miles of offshore border that the Coast Guard could patrol. Once Prohibition started, we started signing treaties with lots of countries to increase that offshore area of patrol. So when rum runners would go to a British-owned island like the Bahamas to pick up their wares, it was legal. It only became contraband until the last 12 miles to shore.
Elizabeth is a cryptanalyst. What is that? And 100 years ago, how long had cryptanalysis been around?
Well, she and her husband, William Friedman, were the mother and father of cryptanalysts. They really started the science that had just been in its infancy during the beginning of the Great War. They trained Great War code breakers. This is signals intelligence. And from that point on, their careers diverged. He was in the Army, and she worked with Prohibition. In World War II, his groups with the Black Chamber helped break Japanese purple. She helped intercept Nazi codes from ship to shore and all kinds of ways. And both of them really helped hone the science of intercepting signals, decoding messages, and then training others to do so.
Surprising craft for a woman?
Yeah, certainly at the time, too. But the two of them got their start over Shakespeare. She'd been hired at a think tank to analyze Shakespeare lettering in the folios because the man in charge of the think tank thought that Shakespeare didn't write them, that Bacon did. And all of there was a big code
Francis
throughout
Bacon.
Shakespeare. Yes. She thought he thought Francis Bacon did. And so she would study the letters and the patterns, and her husband would enlarge them through photograph, and they would compare them. The two of them ultimately figured out it was just discrepancies and type, which really made that man enraged because he wanted this scandal. But through studying patterns, they learned how to read code, and they really taught themselves. And he became someone who not only could break code, but could write code. That's where it all started.
What else should we know about Elizabeth?
That she was a woman who worked outside of the home at a time when that was very unusual, and that her husband was incredibly supportive of her. He would help take care of the children when she had to travel for her job. He would encourage hiring help with the children and with the home. He understood the brilliance of her mind and her calling, and he really supported her. So writing that facet of this novel was wonderful because it was great to have a professional couple that had children who really were great partners for each other.
And tell us about Elizabeth's antagonist, Marie Waite.
A very fascinating shadow figure. I became enamored with the idea of having a woman on the other side of the law as an antagonist when I read about a woman, Elizabeth Knapp, during World War II, who was operating as an Axis spy. But because I had written about World War II twice, I needed to pull back from that. So I started searching through the Coast Guard files for a woman rum runner. There were a few, and I found her. I found Marie Waite and the time where Elizabeth was intercepting code and who she helped catch in Marie's circles all lined up so perfectly for the plot of this book.
How did she get the nom de guerre Spanish Marie?
That is very debated. Everything about Marie is debated. Her ancestry, where her parents were from, if she was born here, if she was born in Spain. And in my book, I have the retiring Bahama queen, Cleo Lithgow, crown Marie as Spanish Marie, because it was important in the trade for them to have a nom de guerre so they could operate and build lore around themselves, make people afraid of them. And so her predecessor kind of encourages the theatrics of taking on the persona of Spanish Marie. So you would have different people saying she's 6 feet tall with glittering blue eyes and a gun on her hip and she puts cement blocks on men and all of these things. Come to find out, Marie was 5 feet tall. She had brown eyes. It was just absolutely hilarious, but she loved the lure of it and fed it.
One of the first things you have us learn about Marie is that she knows she has never had much of a conscience.
Yes. She has grown up poor, and she has felt that life has handed her bad cards. Her first husband was a philanderer. Her second is not much better. She's having a really hard time supporting the children from her first marriage. And her family, her husband and all of his brothers are in the business of rum running. And she just doesn't see how there's discrepancies in cargo. She doesn't quite trust him. And so she wants to get involved in this. And for her, the ends justify the means. She needs to take care of herself the way she was never taken care of. And so she uses that to make every decision that she does.
And as you alluded, both Elizabeth and Marie are mothers.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the story starts with Elizabeth on a Coast Guard boat that stops a smuggler who has his toddler daughter on board. Tell us that story and how motherhood affects these women.
Sure. That story is true. I stumbled upon it at the National Archives, where they have all of the Coast Guard records, from declassified files to newspapers. And I found this clipping about baby Betty, the rum runner's baby. And when she's on board, there's no cursing when Betty's awake, and she plays with empty bottles. And they essentially use her as a decoy so that if the Coast Guard drives by and they see a baby, they think, oh, surely there wouldn't be any booze on board. But then the newspaper got a hold of it, and the father and all the mates said, oh, yeah, we have booze here. We're running, and she's our little mate. And the things like that came out through research were so colorful and funny and interesting and gruesome that anything in the book that seems absolutely absurd is definitely true. So, and then in terms of motherhood, I was fascinated to find these women in history, that they worked outside of the home when most women didn't. And there were many women in power positions, including the assistant DA of Miami. And so I really wanted to get into the minds of and to understand and explore the work-life balance, which continues to be a struggle for women today.
That's historical novelist Erica Roebuck of Annapolis on the record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about her new historical novel, her eighth, this one set in Roaring Twenties Florida, probing the lethal clash between a fearless rum runner and a federal agent sworn to enforce prohibition. It's titled The Last 12 Miles. I am in awe of your skill at finding details in the historical record from which you extrapolate what drives your heroines. But at the start of this book, you gave me the idea you had extra gaps to fill. This is part of what you wrote in your foreword. Quote, I do not typically enjoy working from speculation, but in spite of my frustration, I knew I had to start writing. The words came fast. I began to feel the women urging me to have fun, to remember I write historical fiction. Elizabeth had majored in English, loved Shakespeare, and always wanted to write a book. The rum runner loved notoriety, performance, and theater. I felt permission from each woman to use what I knew and to run with what I didn't. So that's what I did. Close quote. So is The Last 12 Miles less history and more fiction than your other books?
No. When I began, I wrote pure fiction based on history, and then I started introducing fictional characters into history through Hemingway's Girl, through Call Me Zelda. Once I got to the Hawthorns, Nathaniel and Sophia Hawthorne, when I wrote about them, I had so many rich characters in history, I just wanted those people to animate the pages. And I've really been in that space, almost a biographical historical fiction, ever since. With these women, because of the nature of their work, some of Elizabeth's files still are not declassified, and then Marie just not having much of a paper trail, I had to operate more in that fictional space, and I've become very comfortable in the biofiction space. So it required of me to let go a little bit and to have a little fun, and to try to fill in those gaps with more fiction. So I did feel like people who had been with me on this journey had seen me go into biofiction, and this probably takes a step back from it in certain ways. But I do mention everything in the author's note that I had to enlarge or make up. So it is still deeply based on history.
And you said the really crazy,
yes,
notable,
yes,
events and situations you found in the historical record.
Yes, the history, truth is so much stranger than fiction, and it will always be so. And it's my joy to find those little tidbits and share them with the reader.
You wrote an essay last month about how anti-heroes and villains are having a moment in America right now. Certainly Spanish Marie qualifies as an anti-heroine and villain, but you wrote that you empathize with her.
I did. It was an unexpected turn in the character arc. I really felt very, very aligned with my protagonist, Elizabeth Smith Friedman, and I figured this anti-hero, this antagonist, was very cut and dry. But as time went on and I started to understand Marie's motivation for trying to provide for her children, as I see her softening and trying to be a better role model for her children and wishing to leave the life behind and just to use it to get to a certain place, which I think is a lie a lot of people involved in organized crime tell themselves, if I could just get this much, then I can stop. But the world becomes so a part of what they are and who they are, it almost becomes impossible to get disentangled. And I saw on Netflix, there's a show called Griselda about a woman who was a drug lord in South Florida, I believe in the 70s. It was tremendously done, but they also had this, a real anti-hero, a woman who gets involved in organized crime to so-called help her family, and then just becomes involved in a very dark world that brings out her very dark nature in incredibly violent ways. And then you have Taylor Swift with her song, Anti-Hero. I'm the problem. It's me owning it. So we see this across women looking at the shadow side. And I feel like culturally, I see that in a lot of fiction now.
Well, do you think, I mean, as I mentioned at the beginning, that I think a lot of Americans look back on the speakeasies and say, and with sort of fondness or at least indulgence. I mean, did the era you're writing about in this book lead us to being okay with antiheroes?
I think maybe it laid a foundation for it, and that we like to look at the more romantic aspects of it and the speakeasies and how charming all that is. My book takes place at a crossroads. So when it starts, you know, Great Aunt Tilly has a still in the basement to supply the family. There's small operations like that, small owner operators of boats doing a little work on the side. And then organized crime gets a whiff of it and people start to make money and channels open up for drug running alongside alcohol. And then you have human trafficking and it all explodes from there and becomes a very dark place that we still are dealing with the legacy of post-booze, but certainly with drugs and humans. And it is a very dark area. So there is this little film across it, like you said, almost a filter, and that's where it starts, but then it goes south very quickly. And I just explore that crossover in the book.
Before I let you go, I want to get back to Elizabeth's professional work. What we see her do goes way beyond code breaking. I mean, she's not just figuring out what the bad guys are saying secretly to each other. She's divining what they're going to do next and why. Is that history or is that your imagination?
It is. It was fascinating with the couple, with Elizabeth and William, especially when they worked together. They had a very special chemistry. He was a very technical signals intelligence gatherer and decipherer, and everything with him was very STEM related, we'll say. Elizabeth, while she also had that proficiency, she called it her women's intuition. whatever it was, so that when there was something he would get stuck on, he would say a word, maybe the word that came up in a code, and he would ask her what it made her think of, and then she would say whatever came to her mind, and it would help him break his code. And for her own self, she found that by researching the lives of the people she was trying to find, understanding where they came from helped her to break code, because she learned to think the way that they did, to crawl into their minds. So she definitely had, she did call it her women's intuition. She was very technically proficient, but had this extra piece that made her so successful. And in a very short amount of time, she caught up on the complete backlog of intercepted messages, 12,000 messages,
wow.
Decoded all of them. The work that she did helping them nab rum runners is what grew the Coast Guard fleet and really helped establish it as the branch of the military that it is today.
It's a thrilling book. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
Erica Roebuck's latest historical fiction is The Last 12 Miles. She lives in Annapolis with her husband and three sons. At the On the Record page, we have a link to information about the book and her essay for CriminalElement.com about the rise of the antihero. Short break now on the record, and then a Stoop story. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.